From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gralat, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Joshua Landis joins me to discuss the continued escalation of tension in Ukraine and to provide an update on the ongoing conflict in Syria.
Bashar al-Assad and the Syrian army are stronger today than they have been at any time in the last 2 years.
And later, my conversation with African-American scholar and activist Molefi Kete-Asante. He's the author of dozens of books about Afrocentricity and identity.
Part of the running toward Africa is really a running toward a centeredness, a search for my own sense of heritage and agency.
The news is coming up next. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gralat. Joshua Landis, welcome back. Let's do a Syria update. I mean, the conflict in Syria is off the front pages these days, but certainly this conflict is ongoing. Syria has been named this week one of the most dangerous places on the planet for children. Doesn't seem to be much of an end in sight, as we've been talking about forever. But tell us, what is the latest on the
Syria conflict?
Well,
we've come to a landmark of 3 years, mid-March, 3 years into this conflict, and everybody is sort of looking back and saying, what's changed? And the biggest thing is that Bashar al-Assad and the Syrian army are stronger today than they have been at any time in the last 2 years. Everyone got Syria wrong. Most people got Syria wrong, thinking that Bashar al-Assad would fall. Now, I can toot my horn a little bit here because my first big article 3 years ago was Assad's not going to fall. But Syria is devastated. The United States and increasingly many of the countries in the region are beginning to look at Syria as a counterterrorism problem, as something that they're not going to win. Even Saudi Arabia, I believe, which said several months ago that they're going to pour in more arms and so forth to the rebels, is now looking at Syria as a counterterrorism problem. They have banned Saudis from going to fight in Syria. They've said if they don't come back within a short window of amnesty, they will be put into jail. And there are almost 2,000 Saudis that have gone to Syria. There are 400-plus British subjects that have gone to fight in Syria. So everybody,
Europeans. I mean, there have been lots of people flocking
there,
fighting
Germans,
the Assad
regime. There are 50-something nationalities that have gone to fight this holy war in Syria. And so the whole world is very anxious that they're going to come home, be radicalized. And so they're beginning to look at this as a problem. And Assad and his army are trying to position themselves to be the anti-terrorists. And nobody wants to do that because he's a brutal force that has devastated his country. But everybody's throwing up their hands. And unfortunately for the Syrian people, it's been devastating. And that's the terrible thing. So many refugees, children, no more schools, 6 million internal refugees. People can't feed them all, and starvation on a really wide scale.
Starvation,
level.
No schools, no health care. I mean, basically,
and the world's
just
turning the page.
Absolutely devastating inside that country.
It shows you with the withdrawal of the United States, and I have consistently said I don't think the United States could fix Syria problem. Nevertheless, it shows you what humanitarian disaster this has turned into, and partly because there aren't any superpowers that are willing to step up and take responsibility. And so small countries like Syria that don't have patrons can get into a lot of trouble.
Well, as Syria has come off the front page, what's come onto the front page is the continued escalation of conflict, or at least tension, in Ukraine. And speaking of superpowers here, we've got kind of a regeneration of East versus West. We've talked about that before on this show. But this really does seem to be escalating, some tit for tat. The Russians are now running war games on near the border, some military maneuvers on the border. The Germans are starting to get a little nervous. You know, everybody's trying to think about what Russia's calculation could possibly be here, given the long-term political and economic consequences of this. But we need to remember how important Crimea is to Russia. And particularly that port, the Sevastopol port. I mean, this historically, this is the concern. So what are we to expect from Russia? I mean, it's not just about power and access to the base and that sort of thing today. There's much more to the story.
There's
right?
History. There's nationalism. Catherine the Great in 1770s sent Potemkin, her lover and general, down to take the Crimea and the areas around the North Black Sea, which he did. And he developed them. She took an incredible tour down there, bringing hundreds of courtiers with her, and toured the whole place. It is Russian history. During the Second World War, the Nazis occupied Crimea. There, 6-7% of the population were Germans, Crimean Germans. All of them got ethnically cleansed by the end of the war. But they, when the Nazis occupied it, the Jews, who were a big component, got ethnically cleansed. This has been at the center of Russian fighting, Russian identity. The Black Sea Fleet is built around Crimea. And Crimea only went out of Russian hands in 1956 when Khrushchev gave it to Ukraine, which of course at the time was part of the Soviet Union. So he was in a sense giving from one hand to the next hand. Now that Ukraine has decided to leave Russia's orbit and move into Europe's orbit, Russia has sort of reached in and tried to grab this one hunk of Ukraine that is a majority Russian in ethnicity, is such a long part of Russian history. I don't want to make any apologies for Russia and what Russia's doing, but it looks like both sides are trying to save some face in this because it looks like Russia's going to stick, is going to hang on to this.
Well, it doesn't seem like they're going to give up very easily for all the reasons that you just said. And so that now they've got a referendum coming on Sunday in Crimea about secession. And it's really just going to be interesting to watch how that plays out. So I'm sure we'll return to that next week and in the coming days. I mean, clearly, just these two issues alone, you know, the United States and others around the global community are facing these large and even larger diplomatic challenges. And it's just fascinating to watch whether, you know, diplomacy at the end of the day will win the day. As President Obama reminded us in a recent State of the Union address, diplomacy wins, and yet we see diplomacy really struggling in these two cases of Syria.
And we don't want to get into a sanctions, you know, standoff with Russia, because once you put sanctions on, very hard to take them off. And we need to keep our businesses open and keep lines open to Russia, which is part of Europe in a sense.
Well, thank you, Joshua Landis, as always, for sharing your historical perspective with us today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, Suzette.
If you have comments about this discussion or a question for Joshua or me, let us know in the Worldview section of our website, kgou.org. You can also tweet us at worldviews_kgou or at Suzette Gralat and at Joshua_Landis. Coming up, I'll talk with one of the country's leading scholars on African and African American issues. I'm Suzette Gralat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gralat. My guest, Molefi Kete-Asante, grew up in Jim Crow, Georgia, and worked in tobacco and cotton fields as a boy. He has Oklahoma ties, earning his bachelor's degree from Oklahoma Christian College 50 years ago. For the past three decades, he served as a professor at Temple University in Philadelphia, where he created the PhD program in African American Studies. Molefi Kete-Asante, welcome to Worldviews.
Hey, thank you very much. I'm really delighted to be on Worldviews.
Well, it's a real pleasure to have you here. You've had such an amazing career and have written so much, and there's just so many things to say and talk about. But I really wanted to start really with your background and how you got to where you are today, and particularly from this location. You know, you were born and raised in Georgia. You're one of 16 children. And so tell us a little bit about that upbringing and how you ended up coming to this point where you write about your experiences and the experiences of other African Americans in this country and the study of Africa. You've made such an impact on the study and what we know of the history of Africa.
Well, I come from a peasant background, actually. My family, as far as I can remember, started in a county called Dooley County in Georgia, which was at one time considered the most rural county in the United States, and migrated to Valdosta, Georgia, where I was born. I worked in the cotton fields and in the tobacco fields until I was around 16 or 17, but I left Valdosta to go to one of the five African-American boarding schools at that time, and I went to Nashville Christian Institute and, in fact, finished there. But during the summers, I would leave Nashville, Tennessee, and would go back to Georgia to work in the cotton fields. So I see myself as a child of that rural experience in southern Georgia. But it is true. I mean, sometimes when I am at the University of Oklahoma or sitting at the University of London, I wonder how could a person from Valdosta be in such places? And I think it probably had a lot to do with my own aspirations and the support that I received from my father and my mother. And so I was quite energetic as a student and quite devoted to learning, and ended up actually at Oklahoma Christian College.
Now, that's what I found particularly interesting, is that you found your way to Oklahoma.
And I'm really happy to be back in Oklahoma. I haven't been back here since 1964, actually. I was the first African-American to graduate from Oklahoma Christian. And then I left, and I am now back in Oklahoma.
Well, it's great to have you back. So about your memoir, you've written a memoir, As I Run Toward Africa. In this work, you talk about dealing with the meaning of loss, displacement, and dislocation. Can you tell us about what you mean by that and how your upbringing in the United States as an African American, how that led you to really study and try to understand your roots, basically, where you came from?
I think you've really captured what I was trying to capture in the book, and that is this question of loss, this question of dislocation. Even the name that my parents gave me at the time, which was Arthur L. Smith, the name was not my name, and it had nothing to do with my history or heritage. It was basically a slave name, and it was a name that was given to African people by virtue of the condition of enslavement. So part of the running toward Africa is really a running toward a centeredness, a search for my own sense of heritage and agency that was apart from the dislocation that I had experienced and millions of African Americans in the United States, the Caribbean, and in South America, have experienced the same dislocation because we basically are not living on our own terms. So how do you regain a sense of place, a sense of orientation, where you have at least a much greater chance of having some degree of an experience where you are a subject rather than an object? And for me, that had to do with searching out the values, the customs, the traditions, the aesthetics, even in a sense, the spiritual components of what it means to be an African in a world that for 500 years had basically been dominated by Europe, or if not by Europe, by the Arabs. And so you have to come to some understanding of yourself. So knowledge of self was first for me. And I thought that to run away from what I thought was, and I still believe, it was an irrational situation toward rationality, was to run toward Africa.
My guest is Temple University African American Studies Professor Malefi Kete-Asante. More of our conversation after a break. I'm Suzette Gorlat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and my guest is Temple University Professor Malefi Kete-Asante. When we left off, he told me how he changed his name and started looking toward Africa to gain a sense of orientation and identity in his life. So looking for a connection to who you really were and where you came from. And this led to obviously a significant transformation in yourself, not only a change of name, but a change in, you know, your ultimate goals and objectives and where you were going to head, you know, go in life in terms of becoming that educator to let other people know about Africa and where you and others came from.
Yes, thank you. Because you see, fundamentally, the experience of African Americans is one that is quite bizarre and quite odd. if a person, for example, of Chinese background had a name like Arthur Smith, we would look at that and say, wow, that's kind of strange, rather odd, but maybe there's an explanation. But for African Americans with a name like Arthur Smith, we assume that that's normal and that is, in fact, not bizarre and not odd. But for me, it was quite simply one of the oddest things that I could ever imagine. And the way it struck me was when I first went to Africa, and I lived in Zimbabwe, and I've traveled to Africa maybe 80 times all over the continent. But when I was first in Ghana in 1972, I had written a book called The Rhetoric of Black Revolution, and I asked the librarian at the University of Ghana, did they have a copy of my book? And at that time, my name was still Arthur Smith. And he said, yes. He said, but when the book came in, we thought it was an Englishman. And it just struck me that, wow, this is kind of weird, isn't it, to have a name like Arthur Smith and be a black person. This is quite strange. But so this was only just one aspect of the problem. The other problem outside of the name was the loss of history that goes with the loss of names. And this is why the work that is being done by many people now with DNA and trying to discover what are the roots. I mean, you remember Alex Haley's famous book on roots. This whole idea of trying to say, who are we? Where do we come from? What's the background of African people? I mean, what did we call God before we came here? What religious practices did Africans have? What were the languages that were spoken? What music did people hear? What colors did they appreciate? I mean, it was a whole different search and quest. And this is a quest that is at the very core of most African people who live in the Western world, even if it is unspoken. And if a student sits in a classroom in elementary school, this question is in her mind. She's raising this question, but it is never asked of her, or never the answer is never given. So part of my search and my quest, my work, I have been on this quest. This is basically what I've been trying to do.
Well, clearly you've made a significant contribution in this respect. You've written the book, The History of Africa, which has been adopted by most high schools in the country, or many high schools in the country, to try to teach these kids about that history. It's so important. But the subtitle of that book, I want to ask you about that. It's called The Quest for Eternal Harmony. So a history book about Africa that is then subtitled The Quest for Eternal Harmony. What were you trying to get at with that statement?
The most profound concept in ancient African philosophy was a concept called Ma'at. And Ma'at, according to the understanding of this concept, was at the very beginning of the universe. That Ma'at was this is, of course, now the mythical reality is that when the Almighty created the universe, along with the Almighty was Ma'at, that the only entity existing with the Creator was Ma'at. This is out of the Nile Valley civilizations. Ma'at was harmony, balance, order, justice, truth, righteousness, reciprocity. And the example of Ma'at was, or at least the symbol of Ma'at, was a woman with a feather, but who also was the one who was able to judge with the scales, you see. So this notion of harmony, this quest for eternal harmony, comes out of most African philosophy. Because the African philosophy is different from what we have come to know as sort of a Hegelian or Marxist notion of or even more contemporary understanding in the Western world of conflict. That is that you have people in conflict and out of conflict, you get a synthesis and you move on to another form of conflict. This is not African. This is not an African concept. African concept is that the the purpose that we have in the world is to hold back chaos. And to hold back chaos, you always search for harmony, for consensus. You're always searching. Even in situations that look like conflict, you are really trying to find out what is the best way for us to move in a way that brings justice and order and balance. So that's what I meant. The history of Africa, even where you would have conflict, would always be the idea that the queen or the king is a person who has to be looking for this concept of eternal harmony.
Well, along those lines, and lastly, I just have to ask you about something that's been said about you, and that is that you believe it is not enough to know, one must act to humanize the world. What is it that you mean by that? If that's your belief, that it's not enough to know, so you know these things now about Africa, you know, you're teaching others these things about Africa and African history and African-American experiences. What is it that it means we have to act to humanize the world?
Well, I guess what I believe is that, and I've often said this, that I'm not a public intellectual. I'm an activist intellectual. Public intellectuals are normally made by the media. But activist intellectuals are people who do things. I actually do. And not only do I do, I try to create opportunities for others to do. So whether that's creating institutions, whether it's creating journals, whether it's creating organizations, whether it's making it better for teachers to do their jobs in schools, I think that to humanize the world, you can know a lot. You can learn a lot. You can master many subjects, and you can become an expert in many fields. But if you do not act, then it simply becomes knowledge. And that is not the kind of resource that I want to be.
Well, Malefi, thank you so much for being here. Your fascinating story is really enlightening to us, and I appreciate you sharing it.
It is my pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with Temple University African and African American Studies scholar Malefi Kete-Asante. You can find a link to his memoir, As I Run Toward Africa, on our website, kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews alongside the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Nick Aguilera serves as our digital content intern. Hillary Gibson prepared the research for this interview, and the program is produced by Brian Hardzinski. For Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Gralat.